I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. The city of Chicago is celebrating 100 years of Daniel Burnham. Ever the local hero, Burnham is known as the man responsible for the Chicago Plan that many credit for Chicago's central role in the economy of the Midwest. We'll talk with Emily Harris from Chicago Metropolis 2020 about Burnham's plan and what it meant to Chicago and where the city plans to go next. And Abby Friedman has been called one of the world's top style setters by Wallpaper Magazine. He'll join us to talk about the trends he's seen and the trends he started in the way we design homes. All that, plus the latest news from PlanEdison and our City Views commentator Walker Smith coming up on today's Smart City right after the news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Emily Harris is the program director for Chicago Metropolis 2020. It's an organization dedicated to preparing the city for the 21st century by executing new ideas and creating a kind of civic entrepreneurship in the region. She's also leading the Burnham Plan Centennial Committee, a celebration of the 100th anniversary of Daniel Burnham's famous plan for Chicago. Emily, Daniel Burnham is forever associated with Chicago's plan, the Burnham Plan, developed 100 years ago this year. What were the plan's main elements?
The plan really focused on open space and transportation. It was regional and talked about a region extending from Kenosha, Wisconsin, to DeKalb, Illinois, to Michigan City, Indiana, with the city of Chicago, Burnham called the heart. So it really was the plan of Chicago, as you said, but an original plan. And Burnham actually lists six elements that he summarized as the main pieces: the lakefront, the highways, the railway terminals, the outer park system, the circulation, and centers of civic life, which he really focused in on creating a downtown civic center.
Was a plan like Burnham's so original, so different from what other cities were doing?
In 1909, what was really different about the Burnham Plan was that it was so comprehensive, and that it really took a step back and said that American cities that had been growing by leaps and bounds without any sort of rational plan could take a step back and look at what they needed to do to grow, to create a quality of life that was going to be wonderful for everybody and also a great economic boon to ensure the success of the city in the future. So it was an era of unbridled growth, and the radical piece at the time was to say, wait a minute, let's think about this. Let's plan for it. Took a lot of his ideas from Paris and from Haussmann's plans for Paris. So it wasn't something that hadn't been done anywhere else, but it really was new for the American city.
What was it about Chicago that made such a plan move forward in 1909?
I think it was the business leadership. Burnham had this idea that you could plan for a city on this scale, starting from when he had been the director of works at the World's Columbian Exposition in 1893, and proceeded to do several Chicago plans, one for the South Lakefront, and then went on to plan other pieces of other cities. He did the plan for the Mall in Washington, D.C. He did a plan for San Francisco. He did a plan for a part of Cleveland. He did a plan for Manila. And he kept coming back to Chicago and talking to the business leadership here about the fact that we really needed a plan here in Chicago. And he first secured the commitment of the Merchants Club, which was kind of the younger generation of business leaders, but had always talked with the more senior leaders, the Commercial Club. And when the Commercial Club got wind that the Merchants Club had actually agreed to move ahead with Burnham, they merged.
I love that story. That's great.
And so the Commercial Club took on the plan along with the former leaders of the Merchants Club. And one of the great stories is that once the plan was published, there was no plan commission. There's nobody they handed it to the mayor. But they said, okay, now we'll create a plan commission. And that plan commission was chaired by Charles Wacker. and had 300 members, hard to imagine today, and they were all business and civic leaders. So it really was a private enterprise, but it took a number of years before the Plan Commission actually became part of city government.
But the plan was conveyed to the mayor, and the mayor constituted the Plan Commission, or the Plan Commission grew up out of the commercial club?
As I understand it, the mayor may have appointed them, but that really was the same leadership of the commercial club's committees that had been created to create the plan and then went on to lead the Plan Commission.
Yeah, that's very interesting, because in some ways that relationship between the mayor and the business community in Chicago continues today.
Yes, it certainly does. And in fact, the commercial club still exists and founded the organization that I work for that is spearheading this centennial called Chicago Metropolis 2020, which is kind of 100 years later saying, let's look at how we need to plan for the future.
Mm-hmm. Who was Daniel Burnham?
Daniel Burnham was an architect and probably one of the great business leaders of architecture. His firm grew to be one of the largest at the time, and his best known probably for his designs with his earlier partner, John Root. So Burnham and Root designed Chicago's Rookery, and were actually, Root unfortunately died right before the World's Columbian Exposition, but did a number of wonderful buildings here. The Railway Exchange, which is now called the Santa Fe Building, which is the building actually where the plan was designed, is one of them. And he became known for his kind of business acumen more than his design skills. So really built this firm and always had great designers. Root first, then Charles Atwood, who designed the Reliance Building, among others, really known for his incredible curtain walls and taking the Chicago School to new heights in terms of being able to design skyscrapers. Burnham had a real knack for bringing these young designers into his team and creating very successful business.
So many plans sit on a shelf. What made this one different, and why was so much of it actually executed?
I think there's a number of reasons, and one is what we were just talking about, the idea that you had this business and civic leadership who was really committed to making it move forward. Carl Smith, in his book about the plan, talks about this as one of the first really thought-through public relations campaigns. And the campaign was really astonishing, ranging from the incredible illustrations of the plan itself, which were huge, 10 feet by 30 feet watercolor renderings of what Chicago could look like that were displayed in the Art Institute and traveled all over the world. So they had a huge success early on in sort of implanting these ideas in the imagination. And then a very concerted effort ranging from what we like to call the first PowerPoint slideshow. They were lantern slides that they showed everywhere, from clubs to firehouses to churches. They had Plan of Chicago Sundays. And then they also had a miniature version of the plan that they taught in the Chicago public schools that was called the Wacker Manual. And that was taught, we thought, through the 1920s, but we've recently met somebody who studied it in 1962. So there was this incredible public relations campaign. And then the other piece of it was that people were being asked to vote on bond issues continually. And so there were 86 bond issues that passed to implement different pieces of the plan. So the biggest successes, of course, were Chicago's lakefront parks, but there was also a tremendous amount of street widening. There was the construction of Wacker Drive. There was Michigan Avenue and its double-decker circulation system, all of which got implemented.
It's really remarkable. It's a remarkable story. You're talking about the public relations aspect of the plan and how very powerful it was, and it certainly seems to be. I love the idea of Plan of Chicago Sundays. Is that what you called it? Or Chicago? That's so great. What did
yes.
they do? All get together and have a social and talk planning?
I believe they actually had speakers come out and they to churches. And so on Sunday, you know, the minister would give a sermon and introduce information about the plan.
It's amazing. Now, a guy named Walter Moody has been called the Plan Commission's public relations genius. I've been curious. I'd never heard of him before until I started doing some research. Who is Walter Moody?
You probably know as much as I do. I've done a little bit of reading, and Carl Smith, again, really talks about him. But he was very taken with the plan. He was brought on by Burnham to promote the plan itself, and then became the Plan Commission's staff. And as you said, really was the genius behind all of these different things. I know that he was the author of the Wacker Manual, which, as I said, was kind of a condensed version of the plan, created purposely for eighth grade students. And at that time, eighth grade was often the last year. And so it was really intended very directly to help young people who are going out into the world understand what the Plan Commission wanted for Chicago, and also couched as a statement of they need to understand cities and where we come from, because there's a lot of urban history in the beginning of the plan, so that they can be the future leaders of Chicago.
That, again, if you compare our civics today with our civics then, there's a sad lack today of, I think, of public discourse and education around civic issues. So it's inspirational to me to think about what was done then. I'm curious, from the time the plan was developed in 1909 until the time its major elements were built, those that were built, how much time passed?
Well, I think, you know, you could say that some of it is still continuing. You know, with the creation of Millennium Park just 5 years ago, we like to think of as, even though it certainly wasn't in the drawings, in the particular configuration it's in now, the next generation of retrieving the lakefront for great public use and combining art and culture with open space to create incredible civic spaces. Really, the greatest effort was up through the 1920s and early 30s until the Depression. But Chicago's lakefront, you know, continued to be built through the 50s and 60s, and there's even work going on today.
Which part of the plan remain unfinished?
Well, the big piece of the plan that never got built at all was the Civic Center that was proposed to be located at Congress and Halsted, and now, of course, is the site of one of the greatest highway interchanges in the nation, but also the site of the Circle campus of the University of Illinois at Chicago. But the idea that Burnham had was that you would create a great axis along Congress Parkway from the lake to this sort of central location with a huge monumental building in the center of it and a number of civic buildings around it. He and Bennett were involved, as I said, in the plan for the mall, and Bennett later designed the Federal Triangle. So it's sort of that idea of the sort of Washington-esque monumental buildings that would be a heart of civic Chicago. They also thought that Chicago would be 12 to 15 million people based on the growth rates at the time. And so some of that was probably more grandiose than needed to be when it turned out that the population never quite took off that far.
And Congress, of course, hardly became a parkway.
No, that's right. It did become a highway. A lot of what, you know, when people talk about Burnham and say, well, you know, what did he leave us and what did he misunderstand? And one of the things that he may have misunderstood was really the impact that the automobile would have on our society. And I think Congress is sort of a testament to that in a way.
Well, that raises a question, Emily. Why did Chicago not choose to celebrate the Burnham Plan centennial by developing a new vision for the next 100 years, one that was more suited to what we now know and the way things are trending today?
I don't know that that's true. I think Chicago is celebrating the Burnham Plan centennial by encouraging everybody to work towards a new vision. That's very much what our whole committee is about. And while there's not a plan per se, although there is a plan that the Chicago Metropolitan Agency for Planning, otherwise known as CMAP, is putting together that really will be the next regional land use and transportation plan. And CMAP is very much using this anniversary to encourage widespread public involvement in making choices that will result in that plan. And the whole idea of the centennial is to drive people towards that planning process, but also towards others, and to really stimulate a widespread civic dialogue that will result, if not in a single document, in a whole re-energized commitment to visionary planning.
And what are the burning questions that that CMAP is struggling with?
Well, they really are a land use and transportation planning agency. They were recently created. They're just formed about 2 or 3 years ago by merging a land use agency called NIPSI, the Northeast Illinois Planning Commission, and the Chicago Area Transportation Study, CATS. CATS had the federal transportation dollars available to them, and NIPSI had tremendous mapping capability, broad understanding of some of the regional land use concerns, but really never any funding or ability to do more than make suggestions. So now that the two are merged under the leadership of Randy Blankenhorn, the agency is fulfilling its mandate to create a plan in 2010 that is looking at where the region should be in 2040. It's called the Go-To 2040 Plan. And they are looking at issues about how we grow, whether we should put a priority on increased density or whether continuing to spread out is a good idea, whether we should put our primary investment in roads or whether investments should be in public transportation or some combination of the two.
Well, it's interesting in that the Burnham Plan didn't pose questions. The Burnham Plan proposed a plan. There was a point of view. And in some ways to ask, well, should we continue to spread out across the landscape or should we become more dense, as an example? I mean, there are trends that are driving a right answer to that, aren't there?
Yeah, and I don't want to misrepresent. The process going on right now is raising those questions. So really the use of the centennial year is to get people thinking about those kinds of issues and making choices. So this CMAP plan, when it comes out in 2010, will very clearly respond to those questions and set a direction. My sense is, from what the initial results that they're releasing based on many, many public conversations they've had so far, is that increased density and increased public transportation are among two of the values that people in Chicago really hold. And so that's the direction that it's my sense that they'll be heading, and also I have to reveal my bias that I certainly hope they head in that direction.
Mm-hmm. Emily, let me ask you one more question. I've seen the two pavilions now that your committee put in place in Millennium Park for a temporary time, I guess through maybe October. And I know the Zaha Hadid pavilion finally was completed. What was the committee's thought on what it was trying to accomplish with the commissions of these two pavilions for Millennium Park by world-renowned architects, but of a temporary nature?
Well, a number of things. One is the genesis of the idea kind of came from the idea, as we talked about, of the sort of public relations genius of the Burnham Plan and the wow moment in 1909 of these incredible, beautiful renderings that really, to quote Burnham if he said it, you know, stirred men's blood. And so the idea was, well, what could we do in Chicago to kind of get that same kind of wow moment? And respecting the fact that Burnham not only did that through the renderings, but in a way, the whole World's Fair of 1893 was a temporary city that got people really thinking about what could the future look like. We did it again in 1933. So Chicago had this tradition of using temporary architecture. And then finally, the Burnham Plan used examples from Europe. And so we thought, given that building architectural pavilions like these is something that's been done in European cities quite a bit and really hasn't been done extensively in America, wouldn't this be a great time to bring this kind of new form of art and use it as a way to stimulate this civic dialogue we're hoping to create about where do we want to go for the next 100 years? So that was kind of the thought and hope behind these, and they both do it through form and also through the sort of didactics that are on panels around them and in the film, particularly, that's in the Zaha Hadid Pavilion.
Emily, it's been a pleasure talking with you. Thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City.
My pleasure. Thank you, Carol.
Emily Harris is the program director for Chicago Metropolis 2020 and the executive director of the Burnham Plan Centennial Committee. And now for the latest in the world of urban planning and design, we turn to Nate Berg of Plan Edison.
When the power cuts out on city streets, you might be surprised to see what happens. Drivers slow down, yield to each other, and generally drive a lot better than usual. Some transportation planners have been exploiting this phenomenon in a handful of European towns by removing streetlights and signage. As a result, they've seen traffic accidents decline and roads that are much safer to drive on. But according to a recent article from The Telegraph, most of those places tend to be smaller towns or villages. But now, London Mayor Boris Johnson wants to bring that idea to the big city. He's proposed the removal of about 100 traffic lights from a section of roadway right in the center of the city. The lights will be turned off for 2 weeks, then turned back on for another 2 weeks. Officials will monitor intersections to see if there's any noticeable difference in traffic safety. If the experiment turns out as expected, the traffic light removal plan could spread out to other parts of London. Meanwhile, a new report from the Transportation Research Board takes a detailed look at how increasing density can affect the amount people drive. The study examines the relationship between land use and carbon emissions, specifically the reduction of vehicle miles traveled resulting from densification. The data in the report suggests that doubling the density in a metropolitan area can reduce vehicle miles traveled by 5 to 12%. And with an increase in the population by more than 57 million over the next 2 decades, the report concludes that increasing density could be a vital strategy for reducing carbon emissions. And finally, this past weekend was Labor Day, a holiday for many Americans that's often celebrated with a picnic or a barbecue. For many of these celebrations, the venue of choice is a public park, and that's increasingly true during this economic recession when extra cash is limited or non-existent for many Americans. But the supply had a lot of trouble keeping up with the demand this Labor Day. Limited public park spaces for barbecues and picnics had some Washington, D.C. residents claiming spots as early as 2:30 in the morning, according to a recent article from the Washington Post. Compared to 2008, Virginia State Park saw a 14% increase in use this 4th of July, and officials expected similar numbers for Labor Day. But for those who arrive too late to claim a spot, those increases are little more than a sign their cities aren't providing enough public spaces. For Plan Edison, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is the assistant editor of PlanEdison.com. Coming up after the break, we'll talk to architect Avi Friedman, and we'll find out his strategies for developing homes and entire communities sustainably. I'm Carol Coletta. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Avi Friedman is an architect and urban planner. Born in Israel, Avi is now based out of Montreal and continues to work worldwide, building more than just homes. He builds entire communities. Now that the market for new homes is in the tank, people are rethinking the possibilities for adapting their existing homes to changing lifestyles, making a home last longer for a particular family. You've been thinking about that for a long time. What are we missing in the way we design and develop homes?
In my view, we are not thinking about the home in a long-term perspective. When we conceive or even purchase a home, we think about a limited period, say, the beginning of our life as a family and so on. But when people get older, they recognize that their needs are changing very rapidly. And when they attempt to adapt the home to their evolving conditions, they recognize that it's not so easy. What I am attempting to do is suggest that homes need to be adaptable, continuously adaptable to the evolving conditions of the family from early stages to later steps, also to the aging process.
How do you make homes continually adaptable? It sounds like a really appealing concept to me.
If you are, for example, to think about the relationship between parents and children, you will find that when the children are very young, they would like to live in close proximity to their parents. As they get older, they would like to distance themselves and claim privacy in their own lives. What I believe is that certain amount of partitions in the design of a home can be made demountable, and things can be designed to be changed. If you are to design a kitchen today, you are designing it for most likely a person who is able and so on. But as we get older, we cannot reach the upper cabinets, for example, the upper shelves. And kitchens can be designed to be lower, namely that the upper cabinets can be moved down. Portion of the lower cabinets can be taken completely out. So a person on a wheelchair with a reduced mobility will be able to wheel themselves into the sink, for example, if they are to be used. If you are to design a bathroom, the requirements of a bathroom, say, by an older person will be completely different than a young one. And I suggest that from the very beginning, we need to conceive homes and design them to be modifiable or changeable to our evolving needs, and also to make them easy to be used by people with reduced mobility as they get older.
How do you get architects and developers thinking in these terms of adaptation over time? Have you made progress? Because again, I know you've been pushing these ideas for many years.
What I recognize that throughout the time when I was studying, researching and building using these ideas, there was tremendous progress in technology. Say, if you are to think, for example, about how we wire a home, we needed to run wires to all the walls. Today, we can use our laptop anywhere in the home because we have wireless communication. In the past, we used to build walls that are steady, sturdy, like with gypsum or with brick. But today, we have many, many systems that can enable us to remove partition very easily and so on. What happened is that in the past 20 years, we saw tremendous evolution in the production or development of many components that make the adaptability of a home an easy task. And what I suggest from the very beginning when I talk to architects or developers, that what they will do better if they will consult the client about their needs and then continue and allow the client to select the interior and make them modifiable as they go along. And this can be easily done when they will consider new technologies that have been introduced in recent years.
That makes sense. You've been looking at the trends that ought to drive residential housing market, the trends that the residential housing market must respond to be successful. What are some of those trends?
We are living, I believe, now in a what one may call a perfect storm of upcoming changes that we need to watch very closely. I believe that the most bold fact is that we are getting older. America is getting grayer. And the first of the baby boomers are begin to retire. It is unlikely that they will all be able to house themselves in institutional care of some sort. In other words, homes will have to be the way we will probably live the rest of our lives. And this is a major trend that affects many issues. Another important thing is that not many would like to retire and do nothing. Many people are launching now what we call sign-off careers. And you see today that many homes are seeing new home offices being constructed or built in them. So this is, again, another trend that is major that affect the way we will use. But this population segment will use the home. Another important trend has to do with the way we construct home, the more technical part of building housing. And we see their complete revolution. We are moving now from the traditional way of construction using common materials to the greener field and way of building. We are recognizing that we have known that the sources of energy that we are consuming are very, very expensive, and we are attempting to introduce alternative sources of energy. I believe that in the coming years we will see rise, similar to what we see now in some European countries and in, say, in Asia, in Japan, rise in solar energy. So the source to which we power our homes is likely to change. There will be also changes in the way we see the home, the immediate area around the home. Home is no longer conceived or seen as a place in which you shelter yourself, but I see many homes that are growing their own food, either indoor or outdoor. And this is a new trend that is going to be increased in the coming years, and it may take place either in the home itself, in the backyard, or in the neighborhood. Another trend that is coming is the what we call the intensification. We are living in a greater density than we used to live before. We are recognizing today that the notion or the idea that you live in a place and drive an hour or so to your work and come back does not make sense. In other words, the cost of energy, which is fluctuating now and most likely will continue to increase in the future, will require of us to think of what we call the middle landscape. Today we have cities and we have suburbs. Cities are places where you live in densities of, say, 60 to 100 units per acre. And suburbs are places that are designed 4 to 7 units per acre. We did not spend much time on inventing the middle landscape, say, places in which you will live in densities of 25 units per acre. This is another issue that will no doubt will consume a great deal of energy on behalf of planners in the coming years. Another issue that really become very important now is what we call healthy communities. In the past, we used to be more active, to have more active lifestyle, which unfortunately now ceased to exist. We now rely entirely on the motor vehicle to go places, and kids are no longer playing outside as they used to. As a result, we see a tremendous increase in the rates of obesity, and physicians are diagnosing in many communities kids as young as 9 with diabetes type 2. What we are seeing now that we are introducing into many communities, all the components that will make us want to be more active. It doesn't mean that we will, but we will have opportunity to see, say, play areas near homes. We will see more bike lanes. We will see more public transit. We will see communal exercising and so on in order to keep us in shape.
It's a fascinating list of trends that you cite that make up the perfect storm. One thing you didn't talk about that, again, I know you've done much work on, and that is around affordability. You know, when we think of affordable housing in America, we mostly think of the price side. How do we subsidize the price of housing? But rarely do we consider deeply the changes that we could make that would affect the cost of housing. You have ideas on that too. How could we lower the cost of housing?
I think that you brought one of the most important, if not the most critical things about how we're going to house ourselves. In the past few years, we all recognize that we drifted away from common sense when we all embrace huge, huge homes. What happened is that the cost of housing is related to their size. When you buy something big, you pay more than what you pay if you are to buy something smaller. What we have done in the past few years, we engraved those standards, big lots, big streets, complex infrastructure in our bylaws and zoning. What we need to do, what we are doing in fact, is start to rethink some of these principles. And it happens on a variety of levels. Say, buyers ask themselves, does it make sense to mortgage my life for many years rather say being able to pay my mortgage quickly and not subject myself to a huge debt. And I believe that what happened in the past few years in Canada and in the United States with the mortgage crisis was a wake-up call. Many communities are asking themselves, oh, should we build these huge roads? I believe that they recognize that in many of these streets, you can bring a pillow and a mattress and sleep in the middle of the road for enough between 9 in the morning to 5 in the afternoon, and nothing will happen to you.
I completely agree. I point this out a lot, but I've never pointed it out quite in that dramatic way. I love that.
That's right. And we equipped most of the homes have 3 or 4 garages that, in my view, make them sometimes look like big car washes. And then we are failing to introduce public transit that will avoid us building an infrastructure that accommodates the car. Now, these are some of the trends or the directions that need to happen in order to bring costs down. In addition, there is another trend that is supported by, again, technology. We, in the past few years, have been able in other fields, say electronics, biomedicine, for example, to go to the hospital and have a procedure in a day, and we are back at home in the afternoon or the evening. Unfortunately, the same innovation and the same technological advantages fail to find themselves, their ways into home building. And I think that in the next few years, we will see us becoming much more efficient in reducing the cost of housing. Another strategy that you may have heard of was the idea of the grow home. What we have suggested that home can be designed to be smaller and that portion of them will be left unpartitioned for buyers to complete on their own when they have more means. This happened to be amazingly successful in Canada, and it's now being built across the ocean in Europe. So the idea of building spaces, finishing, it will look like a loft, but there will not be partition. But in the future, when you have more means, your family grow, and you would like to complete these spaces, you will be able to do so.
You make a very good point about the innovations that have occurred in so many fields simply have not made their way to home building. Why is that?
It is a very intriguing question. If you are to make analogy between the car and, say, the car industry and the home building industry, we found ways to keep cost of cars down. The industry is not successful at the moment because of the crisis, but it is a very, very efficient way of building vehicle and other products that we are building online. What happened is that after the Second World War, traditional home building was so successful that there was no need to invent an alternative way of building, say, in a plant, in a factory, the way we build, construct cars, for example. And demand continuously exceeded supply. And builders were able to communicate to buyers that anything that you build in a factory resembles a trailer, homes that is of a lower quality. Once again, in the past few years, we saw a tremendous amount of advantage. And we see now that building homes in a plant where things are becoming much more efficient. But the nature of our home building industry is such that there are only very few builders that are constructing large number of homes. In other words, in the home building industry, traditionally, we don't have like the GM or the Ford of housing. We have a few large corporations in the United States, but not many. The industry is still dominated by small builders who do not want to assume any risk whatsoever. They do not want to take a chance because failing in any of these chances entails that they will lose a tremendous amount of money and may not be able to recuperate from these losses. So we stuck over the past half century to very traditional patterns, and we did not attempt to introduce innovation on a large scale.
Let's talk for a minute about sustainability and sustainability at a neighborhood level. One of the trends you mentioned was that we were going to begin rethinking the source of energy to power our homes. I know you've also, in addition to rethinking the home and its adaptability and flexibility, in addition to rethinking affordability, you've also been thinking about sustainability at a neighborhood level. What's your mental checklist as you think about sustainability at a neighborhood level? What does a comprehensive sustainability strategy look like?
The basic idea behind sustainability, if we are to go to the fundamentals, for example, is that we cannot consume on account of future generations. Everything that we do today needs to satisfy our needs while leaving room for other people who will come after us to enjoy. Another important element when we talk about sustainability is the need to recognize that you, in all our decisions, we need to integrate four pillars, four components. The first one is our economic well-being. If society is not economically well, something may happen. Environmental issues need to be considered, the relationship between the community and its environment. The third element has to do with the social needs. Community has social needs and so on. And a fourth one is cultural issues. Culture is important. We need to celebrate our culture. When society have all kind of manifestation in cultural activities, it's known to be very good society. Now, what happened is that we failed to do things on a few levels. The first one is that we believed we did not see our systems as self-sustaining. Say, the home need to draw energy from the power line, where homes can power themselves if they have solar power. What we fail to understand is that one issue, one pillar is related or affecting the other, meaning that if society or community is culturally well, it's most likely will be socially well and economically doing very well. The third element was that when we constructed something, we always did it when knowing we did not avoid making a negative impact. So if you are to develop a development, a community, and you cut trees, you create a negative impact. There will not be forest there that will affect the flora and the fauna. And finally, we did not think about the far distance. Let's build homes for today, but once you build them and you don't have, say, public transit, you will have to drive every day. So if you are introducing public transit from the very beginning, you may rely less on the motor vehicle. Now, what happened in the past few years is that we have become very, very efficient in building developments of what we call subdivisions. But we fail to know how to build communities. Communities are places where people relate to each other, where you have wonderful, wonderful interaction between people, where we respect nature and we respect each other, and we have places in which we can celebrate our culture, get together on the 4th of July and celebrate and do all the wonderful things that communities provide us. We have become, we engineered communities or development to that. We know the sizes of the sewer and the sizes of the road, but we fail to understand that once you take out, once you engineered out this other component from the life of a community, it's really a lifeless. And I believe that sustainable communities or developments will be those that will not only dwell on environmental issues, how to save water, how to recycle materials and so on. But they will also will be communities in which people will relate to each other wonderfully. What I commonly do in my designs is that on the front of each building, I build a porch, design a porch. And I believe that porch is more than an architectural statement. It is a place that enables somebody to sit, and another one who pass right by will be able to pause and talk to the person who sit. In my neighborhoods, I design trees under which people can stand on a hot day and talk to each other. I insist that two sides of streets will have sidewalks. I insist that we will have benches. I insist that there will be public arts because it educates us a lot. I bring these elements. I insist that there will be also urban agriculture where people will be able to start to grow their tomatoes if they want and so on, as well as play area and so on, when kids will be able to gain some confidence when they play and so on. Once you introduce this feature, you get wonderful, wonderful neighborhoods similar to the way we used to build them in the past.
You've been called one of the world's top style setters by Wallpaper Magazine. How do you move new ideas like those that you produce into the marketplace? How do you popularize them?
I believe that in my case, I always looking for a first person who will be delighted and willing to experiment with me. The building industry is a tough one. Nobody buys ideas on paper. People will accommodate and entertain new ideas if we'll see something built that has some financial ground or reasoning to it. So what I'm attempting to do throughout my work is to build a project. Once the project has been completed, I then attempt to advertise, to make it known to my writing and publication, incorporate those ideas in my books, and I believe that then the life of the idea begins. It's traveled from place to place, and it starts to echo and resonates with some, and people, like people who, builders, who see them say, it makes sense. Buyers who read about them in, say, popular media, go to the builder and say, can you introduce this element to our community and so on? It takes time. It's known that in the home building industry, it takes between 9 and 15 years to introduce new ideas. So some of the things that I introduced 20 years ago are now mature and they are affected their communities. Other are making their way, and I believe that in the future that will be part of our, if you want, urban reality.
It was such a pleasure talking with you today. Thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Avi Friedman is an author, architect, and planner, and we have a link to his work on our website, smartcityradio.com. Finally this week, the next generation of consumers has arrived, and our CityViews commentator Walker Smith gives us a look at how the millennials will change the economic landscape.
Baby boomers are tapped out. We are the generation that fueled the great spending boom of the past 30 years. There were lots of us, and we spent lots of money, and when we ran out of cash, we used credit. As baby boomers came of age, the average monthly savings rate steadily dropped. Beginning in 2005 and lasting until April of last year, it was less than 1% of average monthly incomes for all but 2 months. It was even negative 1 month. Not only did we not save any money that month, on average we spent more than we earned. It was we baby boomers who traded in our starter homes for McMansions, who went from Toyotas to Beamers to luxury SUVs, who put our stereos on the streets and replaced them with surround sound, flat screen, home entertainment systems. Boomer fads were hot trends. Boomer tastes were big business. Just ask Nike or McDonald's or CNN or USA Today or any fitness club owner. Indeed, ask people in other countries. Boomer spending made the rest of the world rich, too. Imports, outsourcing, commodities like oil, and travel of all sorts, adventure, eco, and luxury, spread boomer dollars around the globe. But now it all seems to have come to an abrupt and unsettling end. In our frenzy to have it all, we overextended ourselves. On the one hand, too many of us bought houses we couldn't afford, and then on the other hand, too many of us were taking huge financial risks based on those houses. When it all started to grind to a halt in late 2005, it was too late to do anything about it. Boomer spending had given out. With the benefit of 2020 hindsight, we can see that a lot of what boomers had to spend was not sustainable. Boomers had money to burn because of some one-time boost to income that eventually had to give out. Things like women in the workforce, credit cards, run-ups in the asset values of stock and real estate. When you look into the future, What you see are boomers ready to wind things down and doing so with depleted resources. While boomers will still be a major part of this economy, we will not be the driving force that we have been for so long. Someone else is going to have to make up that difference. And there is a generational cohort with the size to do so. It's the group of so-called millennials under the age of 30. When you look at who's been hurt worse by this recession, it's not boomers or millennials, it's the generation in between, so-called Generation X. This is no surprise. They're in their 30s and very early 40s, so they are in a life stage with big demands, first houses, young kids, college funds, and with less time so far to have accumulated much wealth or backup funds of any sort. They've been hit hardest by the downturn. So like boomers, they'll be hard-pressed to lead the way out of this recession. Millennials, though, are not going to be the same kind of spendthrift consumers that boomers were in their 20s and have been their entire lives. But millennials can lead the way in whatever way they feel most comfortable. After all, they've already changed the political landscape of America. They pretty much elected Barack Obama as president. 90% of Obama's popular vote margin was accounted for by voters under 30, and in all of the 2004 red states that swung blue in 2008, such as Virginia, Indiana, New Mexico, and North Carolina, the percentage of voters under 30 voting was up 5 to 7 percentage points. So now millennials will have to transform our economy as well. The direction they will take us is yet to be determined. But their determination is what will make the difference that matters for the welfare of us all. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is the president of the Yankelovich Monitor, a trend service of the Futures Company. There's lots more Smart City on our website at smartcityradio.com. You can read my blog, sign up for the weekly newsletter, or subscribe to the podcast. You can also get in touch with us by clicking on the contact button or by emailing us questions to questions@smartcityradio.com. Smart City's web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit hydefoundations.org. I'm Carol Coletta.